This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's turn first to Dan Carton. He's the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and he's down there at the state capitol keeping a close eye on all of the Northwest Indiana legislative delegation and all the other lawmakers, too, I guess, for that matter, too. Hi, Dan. How are you today?
I'm great. How about yourself?
Well, I guess I should say you're not keeping a close eye on the Northwest Indiana delegation because they're probably all scattered around the building by now, I would imagine.
They are. And, well, and the House and Senate met early today, so I imagine they're probably all scattered on I-65 heading back home.
If they were if they didn't have to be in there tomorrow, yes, to be sure, they'll be out there making their way back to catch up with things at home if they can do so while the weather's decent. They're talking about some snow coming down to central Indiana this weekend sometime. Not a blizzard, but just enough to aggravate
about 4 inches. Yeah. We haven't actually gotten very much. We've only gotten 0.9 inches of snow this year, which is nothing compared to what you guys have gotten up there. So it's
now in some places they've gotten a lot more than that. Certainly around for us here around South Bend, they've gotten much more snow than even we've had here in Lake and Porter counties. But that's usually the time of year that you expect the very start of the legislative session. It starts to weather starts to get dicey, I suppose. So this time to look out on the roads and see how they are. Well, let's take a look at what our lawmakers are doing here. First, let's take a look even further than Indianapolis. Let's look on Capitol Hill, and we understand that the new U.S. senator is put in his first bill.
Senator Mike Burhan, the Republican who defeated Joe Donnelly in November, has filed his first proposal. It would prohibit members of Congress from getting paid during a government shutdown. There are a lot of members of Congress who give up their pay during a government shutdown.
Yeah.
In this case, the Congress is one of the agencies that was funded, so it's they're not facing the same problems as TSA or some of those other agencies whose appropriations legislation didn't go through. So under Braun's plan, members of Congress wouldn't automatically, by law, wouldn't get paid during a government shutdown. The problem is the 27th Amendment prohibits changing the pay that members of Congress receive until there is an election in the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really... Basically, what Braun wants to do can't be done. You could punish them farther on, but it would be kind of crazy to punish some new congressman elected in 2021, perhaps as a result of outrage over the shutdown, by cutting that person's pay because there was a shutdown in 2019.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's a familiar idea. Ironically, one of the people Braun beat in the primary, Todd Rokita, was a big proponent of it. It gets him a lot of headlines and it gets him a lot of attention, and it makes clear where he stands on the shutdown, but it's probably unlikely to become law.
Now we know that Braun and his colleague Todd Young and some other folks on Capitol Hill have picked up, I guess, their assignments on their respective House and Senate committees. That's one of the stories that you have. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, they're so the new Congress started on January 3rd. That's when Braun was sworn in, and they've each gotten their committee assignments. Braun is going to be on 5 different committees, which should keep him pretty busy, as he gets to work in the Senate and files his legislation and starts considering other proposals and moves things along through the process. Senator Todd Young, the state's senior senator, actually got put on the Senate Finance Committee, which is an extremely powerful committee because it handles basically everything related to taxes. So he's going to be in a position as we go through, we have this surging federal budget deficit. The national debt is over $22 trillion now. So there will be a lot of issues for Senator Young to work on the Senate Finance Committee in this new role.
Mm-hmm. I also understand, too, that Congressman Pete Fisklosky here in the region is, of course, he's been on many committees for a long time during his tenure on Capitol Hill, but he's getting closer to being the leader, especially, too, with the changeover in the House with the Democrats now in control.
Yeah, Congressman Viscosi is actually in a really good position. He's one of the longest-serving Democrats in the U.S. House. I want to say he's seventh in seniority out of all 435 members. So, I mean, he's been there since 1982, so that's a long time. And his position, his main committee assignment is the subcommittee on defense, to lead the subcommittee on defense for the House Ways and Means Committee. So he would oversee all defense spending. It's a position he's had as the ranking Democrat, the top Democrat, for the past 2 years when the Republicans controlled the House. But now that the Democrats control the House, Viscosi is set to become chairman of this extremely important subcommittee, one of the few things in government that both parties tend to be pretty reluctant to cut is defense spending. So we've got, you know, a Gary guy right in the center of it, managing how the nation, the entire country, is going to be spending its money on defense.
Wow, interesting. Well, let's catch the State House news here in particular now. One of the stories that you had out there, imprinted online, is taking a look early on here on the priorities that we see that House Republicans and the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus seem to differ a little bit. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they both agree on teacher pay hikes. They don't have a shared opinion on how to pay for them. In fact, should be a story going up on the Times website here shortly with more details about the governor's budget proposal that doesn't include dedicated money for teacher pay hikes. This is an issue that you've been seeing in states across the country. Some of these states have had teacher walkouts or teacher strikes, or it's called the Red for Ed campaign, where they stand outside the school wearing red T-shirts to call attention to the fact that pay for teachers hasn't really kept up with inflation. And we're in this time where there's this teacher shortage, so the bargaining power of teachers is increasing because fewer people want to put up with everything that comes along with it. So teacher pay is going to be a big issue all session long. House Republicans are looking at a strategy to fund it, possibly by, kind of a complicated thing, but basically it would kind of force school districts, without necessarily forcing them, to take money away from stuff that the House Republicans believe is less important and make them spend it on teacher pay.
No.
The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus also supports teacher pay increases, and State Senator Eddie Melton, Democrat from Gary, has a plan that would provide a 5% increase in over the 2 year budget period to teachers, so 2.5% increase each year, using existing funds that the state has that he thinks isn't being put to the best use. So, this is going to be one of those issues that gets debated and hashed out over the entire legislative session, and we probably will only know at the end of April, when the final state budget comes out, whether teachers are going to get a state-funded pay hike.
Yeah. I know, too, one of the other issues that we already talked about just at the outset of the session this time, which is now coming into play, is the latest discussion about bias or hate crimes, however wish you what to put the topic. And Senator Mike Bohachek is in the thick of it now with his measure, I understand.
He is. This is, hate crimes, bias crimes. It's been an issue for a number of years. Indiana is one of five states that doesn't have one of these laws. And the business community increasingly sees it as kind of a black mark against the state, trying to recruit companies to come to Indiana because those businesses are worried that their employees could face discrimination or unnecessary harassment. They don't want to go to a state where that's going to be the case. So what this law would do, contrary to some of those fears that are out there, it doesn't criminalize hateful thoughts. It doesn't stop people from saying hateful things. But if you commit a crime, so there has to be an underlying crime, an underlying felony crime that is motivated by hate, which would be determined at the trial, then the judge would be authorized to increase the prison term that the person who is convicted of the underlying crime would serve. So every crime in Indiana has an advisory prison sentence, but there's also a minimum and a maximum. And judges weigh what are known as aggravating factors to move closer towards the maximum, or mitigating factors to move closer towards the minimum. And then they weigh those to figure out what the right sentence should be. So this would make a crime motivated by bias as an aggravating factor. So a judge could take that into consideration and potentially move the advisory sentence for the underlying crime closer to the maximum penalty if the judge thought that was relevant and there were no comparable mitigating factors.
I know. So no, I should mention, too, that some of these topics have come up not only in separate stories that you've had in the Times, but one story or one, topic in particular that you got put under the issue, the heading of hot issues, which is what lawmakers are dealing with during the winter months here. Something, I guess, to keep everybody warm, I would imagine. You covered some of these already here, but let's catch some of the other topics that you've got on the list there that will likely come up here for good discussion. Of course, the budget will be, definitely, since it's a two-year state budget writing session. We haven't even heard from the governor yet about his official ideas. I know that'll come up soon, too.
It came out this morning,
Okay.
A couple hours ago, so check the Times website. Great story about that.
Good. I know that there's a lot that we're expecting. I'm sure that the governor, of course, is going to highlight a lot of these things on his State of the State message when it comes up here soon. And you mentioned in the hot issue story about not only the impact that the budget's going to have on operations in general, and you talked a little bit about here for the teacher pay issue, but also, too, school safety is another issue I know is going to come up, isn't it?
Yeah, the governor is proposing to keep state's school safety grant program at the same level it was or it is in this current budget year. So originally, the state was only providing $9 million. During the special session, they threw another $5 million in there following the Noblesville school shooting. So Governor Holcomb is proposing to make $14 million available in 2020 and in 2021 that schools can access, request, and use to harden their buildings or hire a school resource officer. There's a wide variety of safety options that are there. So there'll be $28 million in the governor's proposed budget for school safety initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And I know, too, that, I think earlier this week we had an opportunity to hear from, once again, the marijuana supporters, medical marijuana in particular, with Senator Karen Talion and the other people. They had a big rally, I guess, in the rotunda there earlier this week, didn't they?
They did, yeah. Marijuana is picking up as a legitimate issue. Not mm-hmm. that it was illegitimate before, but 33 states now have medicinal marijuana. An increasing number of states are legalizing recreational marijuana. Michigan just did it in a voter referendum in November. So there's going to be legal marijuana, just north of Northwest Indiana, coming up here as soon as Michigan gets its regulations in place. So Indiana has to start thinking about, how that's going to affect Hoosiers. If somebody drives to Michigan and uses a legal product in Michigan, can they get fired from their job in Indiana, mm-hmm. even though they didn't, break the law in Indiana? So even beyond the should Indiana legalize it, there's a whole swath of marijuana-related issues that state lawmakers need to deal with in this coming session, especially in light of legalization in Michigan.
And I also know, too, that you brought up the topic in the hot issue story from earlier this week about voting, and voting and elections in particular are a couple of things that you have highlighted in the stories here. Let's catch at least some thoughts here about the hot issues one. And then if we can, let's address the latest thing here involving Porter County.
Yeah, so there's increased attention being paid to gerrymandering across the country, and this is the drawing of legislative district boundaries to favor one political party over the other. In Indiana, the General Assembly draws the legislative district boundaries after the census. That's coming up in 2020. And if Republicans, presumably, can maintain their control of the state house, they will have complete say over how those lines are drawn, which quite likely would keep Republicans in power at the state house for the next decade. There have been some pushes to put in place an independent redistricting commission or to take other steps to prevent the partisanship from swaying how those lines are drawn. They haven't gone anywhere in the past, but there's a new energy, a new national energy behind that, especially as we get closer to the census and when those districts are drawn in 2021. On the Porter County thing, everybody remembers there was a debacle or fiasco, however you want to describe it, in November when Porter County didn't end up reporting its election results for 3 days after the election. State Representatives Ed Saliday from Valparaiso, Mike Aylesworth from Hebron, want to take the elections in Porter County away from the clerk, out of direct control of the clerk, give the power to a 5-member board of elections and registration, similar to what they have in Lake County, and hopefully, in a sense, professionalize elections. And the idea is to make them less chaotic, especially compared to 2018.
One of the things I was going to ask, and in particular about this bill, since it's things have gotten sorted out as to what committees, I'm sure that most everything, if it hasn't already been assigned to be considered, is going to be. And I wonder where this one in particular, if it's made it in time to get its own assignment.
Yeah, that's going to be in the House Elections Committee, which Representative Saliday actually serves on. So there hasn't been, as far as I know, there hasn't been a meeting of the Elections Committee yet. But that will be coming up presumably later this month. At the start of the session, things kind of go slow as bills get introduced. Today is the bill filing deadline. So by the middle of next week, all of the bills will be assigned to committees, and committee chairmen and chairwomen will start, hearing those legislation. The governor's also going to give a State of the State address on Tuesday. And that after that, things really start picking up in terms of legislative activity.
Well, we'll make a note here that we'll be back with you and check back in, if not this next week when it's time to take a look at what's happened at the State House. But we'll probably, no doubt, have opportunities to find out what the latest is, too. Like you say, with the governor coming up here to talk before his joint Indiana House and Senate session for his little speech coming up. And I'm sure we'll find out more stories, too, and we'll keep an eye on them in the Times. Thanks very much, Dan, for joining us today about all these updates today.
Happy to be here.
Dan Carton is the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Greg Tejeda. He covers news out of Gary City Hall and other related governments for the Post Tribune. And as always, Greg, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, and have a happy 2019.
Thank you. Thank you. We hope we're getting off to a good start anyway. Certainly an interesting start now that we've gotten one election cycle out of the way, the big noisy one involving the state and federal candidates, at least, now we're taking a look at the municipal races, and in particular, you've kept a close
now
eye.
Now we get to the election that matters.
That's right. Now we take a close look at here, for example, what's happening in the city of Gary here. In fact, that's one of the stories that you had up there we wanted to talk about today. Tell us about your story of at least how we're starting to shape up here as far as the candidacies for not only for Gary Common Council, but maybe even for mayor of the city of Gary.
Well, it appears everybody wants to come back. A lot of as far as the council is concerned, a lot of the councilmen plan to run for re-election, with the exception of Carolyn Rogers. He's decided that after 20 years, he's going to retire with 90 grandchildren. And then there is Councilwoman Levita Sparks-Wade, who wants to move up to mayor. She wants to challenge the mayor. She believes Karen Freeman Wilson has not adequately addressed the concerns of the people, is too concerned with the business interests, her own personal interests. So she's getting ready to take her on, and it's probably going to be one of several people who will try running from there. So it'll be an interesting free-for-all there.
There's some people that I know, as you mentioned, are going to come back in particular. We know that besides the fact Carolyn Rogers has decided she's not going to run for re-election, so that's going to open up a nice seat there. for her particular seat on the council, but also too we've got Ron Brewer who's decided he's going to hang around for a while too. I understand.
To my knowledge, I've spoken with all of them. They've all indicated they want to come back to their current position, mm-hmm. with the exception of Rogers and Sparks Wade. Those are the only two I'm aware of that would be opening up those two seats.
I understand too. In your story, you mentioned this too when you talk about Carolyn Rogers. She kind of did little. Prognostication here about what the next term of office for the Erie Common Council might be, and they're going to have some tough decisions they're probably going to have to make pretty soon on matters that involve economic development, in particular this Buffington Harbor thing.
Well, that's going to be the big issue for the next few years, Gary. What becomes of the casinos? And do they? Because there are plenty of outside interests that would love to get those casino licenses and take them away from Gary. They would desperately love to hang on to them. So we'll have to see how these people manage to resolve their situation.
Yeah, I know they've even noticed lately here that the city of Portage has decided they're going to get into the fray and decide to try to grab one of those casino licenses that the city of Gary may give up. So they've thrown their hat in the ring, so to speak, for that, I guess, too. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. Well, they're likely, as you can tell, since you cover Gary City Hall on a regular basis and the Common Council in particular, that there'll be any more issues, not only on economic development, but trying to deal with the city's finances.
Well, they have to do something with the finances. Right now, we got a budget that really isn't a solid budget. They're going to be juggling money around, transferring constant transfers all over the place in order to make sure bills get paid. I mean, and that's the same problem that got them in trouble with the EMS, the fire department, the emergency fund account, the constant transfer of money about that got out of control. So something has to be done to stabilize that situation. In the end, they're going to have to figure out some way of coming up with additional revenue, and that's going to mean bringing in more business, which is what they're working on, and we'll see how much progress they can make this year and in coming.
One of the other stories I know that you've worked on here that we wanted to touch on today is talking about the Gary Redevelopment Commission. They've gotten to work in the 2019 on some more demolition project contracts here. Tell us about that.
Five contracts awarded to four different companies, all of which are around Northwest Indiana. They're going to be tearing down some buildings at 40 sites scattered around the city. Yeah, it's part of the ongoing effort. They want to clear space and create so that you can bring in new projects, new development, because a lot of these existing buildings have been sitting vacant and have become rather decrepit. In some ways, they're an embarrassment to the image of Gary. You want them out of the way, you want them cleared away, and then you want to bring in something more productive that would lead to a more beneficial future for the city. It's just part of the ongoing effort, you know, with Gary. And the scary part is that eventually, at this rate, Gary's going to be a whole lot of vacant lots and nothing else unless we start seeing evidence of somebody coming in, and we have to wait and see to that end what's going to be achieved.
I know you also mentioned in your story, too, some other Redevelopment Commission work on contracts, in particular, one that they went ahead and extended for a fellow named Gus Frangos. Tell us who he is and how he's linked with the city of Gary.
He is in charge of the land bank in Cuyahoga County, Ohio, which is the Cleveland metro area. The land bank is basically a process, but it's also they have it in Ohio, and I'm aware they have it in Illinois as well.
Mm-hmm.
Governments can work together in a sense to pool their vacant plots of land into a bank, so-called, so that developers can come in, work with the bank, and find, you know, the perfect plot. You know, they can sort of cross over municipal lines in search of finding the place where they can build the projects that cities would then benefit. Indiana, Gary would like to see something similar happen in Indiana, and they hired this person to study Indiana law to see what kind of changes would be needed. And this is something that's going to come up in Indianapolis throughout the year. It's kind of started already.
It's not a complete process, so they cost him some extra money that this advisor can continue to work with them in terms of developing a land bank for Indiana, developing that process by which all these vacant plots they're building up can somehow be constructively put together to create a place, you know, where somebody could come and build something that would benefit the city.
Now, I know that in particular, one piece of vacant industrial land that's up for reuse again here fairly soon, we hope, is the Alliance Steel property. The Alliance Steel wants to buy, we should say. It's a former Republic Steel property, isn't it? And I guess there's a question about a tax abatement issue about that. What's the latest on that? And you've had that in your story, too.
There's actually four different resolutions that have to be approved by the council, and they've approved three of them. However, there's one that's still on hold and is going to get approved come the beginning of February. Although when I say approved, I should be honest and admit that Lavita Sparks-Wade has already made it very clear she hates this thing and she will be voting against it. Mm-hmm. She will speak out against it every chance she gets. This particular measure involves the requirement that a plot of land had been sitting vacant for a certain amount of period before they could qualify to be used, before a tax abatement can be applied to it.
Yeah.
In other words, and technically they found out that this particular plot of land has been vacant since January 31st of last year, which means it hasn't been the full year vacant until January 31st of this year, which would have meant that if they had approved it a couple weeks ago, it could have been challenged on the grounds that it wasn't vacant long enough. So they're holding off on it. And supposedly the first meeting of February, which is, I believe, February 5th, that'll be when the final vote comes. This thing moves forward. However, Alliance has already spent some money on trying to plan for what they're going to build at that site. What they're going to tear down part of the existing structure. They can get a better idea of just how structurally sound this thing is, the interior of it. And that's already been committed to. And then once that's done, come the spring, they can proceed with awarding a contract to some company out there who will come in and rebuild the existing structure there into the modern plant that Alliance wants to replace the facility they have in the Chicago suburbs, Bedford Park, near the Midway Airport.
Yeah. So it seems to you, from what you've peppered on the, and kept an eye on from the story from the council standpoint and the other information, too, that Lavetta Sparks-Wade is more concerned, at least in her view, about the tax abatement rather than of Alliance Steel coming in and rebuilding in that site?
She believes the tax abatement potentially is the city giving away money that they could use for other purposes.
Mm-hmm.
She's a little skeptical of the whole idea. And she feels Alliance is coming in and just getting a benefit, and they haven't really given anything to be worthy of it. She's skeptical.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see what she has to say when this comes back up before the council again, when they have that other vote here in February to finally make it official, I guess, or more legal, I suppose, more than more official about this, to be sure. And as always, Greg, thank you very much for spending time to talk with about the stories that you have that's out there in print and online in the Post Tribune, and we'll be watching for more in the future. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Greg Tejeda is a reporter, covers City Hall in Gary and other city-related news for the Post Tribune. On this Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's turn to Joe Pete now. He's the business reporter for The Times. And as always, Joe, thanks for joining us today. There are a number of interesting stories. Let's take a look here at what the latest is from a couple things here, if we may, from the city of Gary, or at least one business used to be in Gary, and we'll talk about that in a sec. But let's first talk about the Amazon warehouse that is operating there, and they're out there looking for help, I understand.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Gary had attracted, Gary, of course, made the bid for the Amazon headquarters. It was realized it was kind of far-fetched, and, it kind of raised some eyebrows. You had some people like the Washington Post were saying, oh, poor decaying Gary seeking the headquarters. But in the end, it appears to have definitely paid off. There is a new warehouse that opened in the former Tradewinds facility on right by Interstate 65 at by where the USW Hall is over there,
mm-hmm.
on 15th Street. And the company says they've hired up to 500 people already. It's a mix of full and part-time jobs, but it's what they call a delivery station, where it is a warehouse, but it's not one of the major fulfillment centers they've opened, at other places across Joliet and down in the Indianapolis area and so forth, but rather it's like a last mile kind of delivery site where the goods come here and then they get shipped directly from here to the consumer. They've been expanding this kind of network nationwide as they get just bigger and bigger. They are pretty much the dominant force in e-commerce. E-commerce is still only something like 12% of total retail, but Amazon has like a just commanding dominant market share of the online. So just to keep up with demand, they've been opening more and more of these places across the country. And in this case, they did not seek any like tax incentives or anything, but they have been going on a pretty good hiring spree. It is a good location for them. They're right by Interstate 65 and then, you know, the Borman and not too far from the toll road. But they do have a program where they are looking for people. They have been pretty dependent on the post office, and that can potentially cause some problems. Like the administration has been talking about, you know, raising fees on them and that type of thing. So what they're looking to do is establish their own network of courier businesses, and they're looking for people in Northwest Indiana to launch their own courier business where they would pick up packages from this Gary warehouse and then deliver them to the customers. It's something like a upfront investment of up to $10,000, which can be reimbursed if you're a veteran who qualifies. And they would fly you out, or you'd have to fly yourself out, but you go to training in like Seattle for a couple weeks. And then they would set you up with operating a courier business with up to like 40 people and trucks, Amazon branded trucks, and just delivering packages. The company says it could be, potentially lucrative. They're saying that if once the people like ramp up to full speed, they could be looking up. They could be looking to like somewhere between $1 and $4.5 million in revenue per year, and somewhere between like $75,000 to $300,000 in annual profit. But that's only if you get up to like 40 vans and you're running 40 routes.
That's a pretty big operation of your own, I suppose. But it would be worth working if you're able to work with Amazon on that level. That would be pretty good.
Oh, absolutely. And it would be, you'd be working mainly with Amazon, but in theory, you might be able to branch the business off into into other areas. But this is their kind of alternative, or this is their kind of solution to not being as dependent upon, you know, the Postal Service, but also FedEx and, some of these other ones. They're basically building up their own infrastructure now. But they are looking for entrepreneurs to put up the capital to run these businesses. They say they've negotiated, like, special rates on vans, insurance, delivery devices, and you know what they need to get up and running. But the company itself is not like running this, and they're not taking over. The entrepreneur would be assuming any risks, and you know they'd be kind of reliant mostly on Amazon for their business and livelihood.
One of the other things, too, we're talking about the city of Gary here, and it's a new story that is coming up here, if it's not out online already in the Times, at nwitimes.com, is a story about one of the food items that is was still around, nearest and dearest to my heart. Those are Peerless potato chips. I know somebody will wrinkle their nose saying, ew, maybe if more people... I did my share, at least, of buying Peerless potato chips. I apparently couldn't buy enough of them, I guess, to keep the place open. But I understand that your new story has out there that there may be somebody that's interested in maybe opening the place back up again.
Yes, Peerless was pretty beloved for nearly 90 years. It was, I don't know if it was necessarily the healthiest chip, but it was our chip. It was locally made.
I'll swear there was a lot of tallow fat that must have gone into the fryer too, but it doesn't matter. That was part of the flavor. It made it distinctive, you know, yes.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And it was, people were very, very sad when that closed, unfortunately, a year ago, but it was, it wasn't necessarily a lack of demand. It's just they were facing... The owner was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and he was having a hard time finding anyone to purchase it. But they faced all kinds of challenges. They were getting less. Central Grocers had been their main distributor, and they went bankrupt. Yeah. So they weren't basically like 80% of – they weren't getting paid by like 80% of their customers, and it was a very difficult financial period. They weren't being carried as much by some of the bigger chains like Walgreens and Jewel. They have these arrangements that are much more favorable to the large companies like Frito-Lay's than like the small independent guys. And with the co-op going down, they were in a really just bad position. So they ended up closing. People everywhere were pretty sad. It was a pretty hot commodity for a while. People were rushing out, buy as many bags of Peerless as they could. But the good news is now there's a potential buyer that's stepping forward. The deal has not been closed yet, but the buyer appears to have the financial wherewithal to get the factory back up and running and purchase the assets and then start manufacturing Peerless again sometime this year. We don't have too many details of who that is or what their new business plan would be, but the owner is very optimistic that he might be able to cut a deal soon to bring Peerless back.
That's very good. I know it's tough when, and certainly for the suppliers, the supermarkets, when they have to make some adjustments like that. And I'm sure that you say the Central Grocers, of course, which was doing all the supplies as well as owning a lot of the Strachan Van Til and Ultra stores when they were still open, they were the ones that had to deal with that. And so it'd be interesting to see if they can, with their new supplier, which is out of Kansas City, if they can work Peerless in when they're able to get back running and putting out lots of potato chips again.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Strack has been, they have been, especially make, the Kansas City one, they do a lot of the generic brands for them and everything, but yep, they have been making an effort to put a lot of, like, locally made products. They do have a lot of, like local craft beers, like St. John Malt Brothers. They recently started stocking Small Town Coffee, which is going to be opening a new coffee bar soon in Crown Point, but they're a local roaster that's built up a pretty good fan base. But they've been carrying more and more of kind of the local artisans and producers. They have that, there's that smoothie, there's that frozen smoothie company out of Valparaiso where they've been stocking them for a while now, where it's, you just pour like water in and in like 40 seconds you have a smoothie, but yeah, or it's Frozen Garden, I think. But it's like, you know, they've been pretty supportive. Strachan Van Til has been very supportive of a lot of the local food producers. So hopefully when Peerless returns, that they can work out some kind of arrangement.
Well, let's hope so too. One of the great stories, an important story here that came out is in the Times, is from the city of Hammond. This is an update on all the efforts to get the $50 million first phase of the Digital Crossroads Lake Michigan data center opened up there, where the old state line generating plant used to be, right next to the state line, literally, in Hammond. What's the latest, and how soon are we going to be able to see some activity out there on the lake?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, the developers had just announced, which is Tom Dockich, the brother of IU basketball, former IU basketball starter, Dan Dockich, and pretty well-known sportscaster, and Peter Feldman, who's a developer in New York City. They announced they had kind of lined up the funding for their Data Crossroads of America LLC project. It's $50 million for the first phase of the project that they're going to build right there on the lakeshore. Eventually, they're saying it could be up to like $200 million for the project as it grows, but they're going to do it in stages where they'll do like one building at a time and look to, lease the computer space out to large users. It could be anywhere from like hospitals to streaming services like Hulu to Amazon to places of that nature. There's just, as we grow more and more dependent on their phones, there's and everything becomes more and more digitally connected with the Internet of Things. So just, we're generating data like all the time now, constantly, or consuming data, and there's just, they need, you know, warehouses full of computers to store it. Unfortunately, they don't typically employ that many people, but it does represent a significant amount of investment, and this will be moving forward. They're looking at doing like a pretty significant project. They say it would be the largest in the state. It would be kind of comparable to like really big well-knowns like the 350 Cermak one in Chicago, which is one of the biggest ones in the country and just stores a lot of data. This one happens to be by several of the major lines for transmitting data, which are kind of run through the railroad utilities. So this would have great connectivity like around the country. But the big thing, they've been able to line up like some tax incentives from the state and some funds for redeveloping an old brownfield site, basically, because that coal factory that had been there, the state line generating plant, was one of the worst polluters in all of like Chicagoland and, for a brief period, I think, the country. But they, you know, they're putting out a lot of carbon into the atmosphere, and this is a much cleaner use. They are taking lake water to cool off they're using lake breezes and lake water to cool off the computers, the heat that it generates, but they put it back in, and it's basically only been used for cooling. They're not putting out any chemicals into the water like BP or some of the other lakefront industries.
Well, I imagine everybody in the tech industries are keeping a close eye on operations like these data centers, and this one I'm certainly in particular, because most of the ones that you've mentioned before in our past conversations about this are kind of inshore. They're in Chicago, but they're in communities or in suburbs. They're not on the lakefront, and you've got this natural cooling that you have out there, which is certainly what I'm sure that the folks setting up this Digital Crossroads project is looking into in particular. So we may see more of these pop up here, maybe not next door to each other, but probably in the area too. One time I wanted to have an opportunity here before we finish up today, Joe, to talk about the story that you put out here earlier about the one of the latest migration studies, or several of them, of course, but one in particular that's come out here that takes a look at the Midwest and Indiana and why so many people seem to be moving into Indiana as opposed to moving out.
Oh, absolutely. It's the United Van Line study. They just came out with the new year, but it's found historically, basically since 1980, that, you know, there's Indiana, along with most of the rest of the Midwest, has had typically out migration every year, or it's been sort of balanced where you have roughly as many people moving in as moving out. And over the past several years, it's been mostly out migration. People move out for a variety of reasons, like they're going off to college, they are retiring, they're graduating from college and going somewhere like Chicago for their first job. You typically will see a lot of that, not just here, but in any state. But it's been over the last couple of years, more people have typically been moving out than moving in. But for instance, last year it had been about 54% of the state-to-state moves through United Van Lines were out of Indiana, whereas only 46% were inbound. But now in 2018, it flipped where it was 51.3% people were moving in as compared to only 48.8% leaving. So it's kind of a positive balance. This is one area where Indiana has historically struggled. The population has continued to grow, but it's been very, very slow, and a lot of it's been driven mainly by, partly immigration, but then partly also natural births, because you don't have as many people moving here as to other. If you look at these things nationally, there's been a lot of people have been historically leaving the Midwest because you don't have the amount of industrial jobs you once did. And we can frankly state that, you know, the weather isn't always great, especially this time of year.
Yeah.
And people have been moving kind of to the Sun Belt and to the South. And a lot of it is just following jobs or to the coast. And a lot of people are following jobs and opportunity. But you've seen a lot of migration generally especially to the West Coast, to the Southwest and the South. And people are just moving to kind of warmer climes generally. But, you know, last year we did see like a increase in, people moving into Indiana. I believe it was the state's biggest population gain, too, according to the census, in years. It was like 0.5%. It was not, you know, anything dramatic or that would set the world on fire, but it was it was pretty good. And as United Van Lines state, a lot of these are driven by jobs. That's one of the main reasons why people will move from one place to another. Either they got transferred by the company, or they have a new career opportunity, or they're changing careers, or something like that. In fact, roughly 56% of the people who came here last year through United Van Lines did so because of work, and this was the same pretty much with the people leaving. About 67% or two-thirds left because they got a job somewhere else. So that's a big driver in that. But you'll just always have the natural amount where there'll be a number of people any given year who are going to retire and then move to like Florida or Arizona or somewhere like that.
Well, it sounds like the migration studies, they don't sometimes, maybe because they can't get the data in completely, but they should have more of these more often. And so I'm sure they'll pop up again. So we'll have to talk with you about this again, too. And this is another topic, too, that comes up all the time, I know, in relationship to workforce development and here in the region in particular. So I'm sure we'll bring the topic up again in some way or another soon. Joe Pete is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Joe, thank you for joining us today. And we appreciate the looking at the stories that you've had out there in print as well as online, including the late-breaking story about Peerless potato chips, too. Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you very much.
This is Regionally Speaking. It's interesting to note that there are still remnants of the Civil War around in the fact that many of the soldiers who participated in the Civil War activities, whether it happens to be as a soldier on the battlefield or in this case a soldier who happened to basically play in a band, had a chance to keep a diary and tell us what life was like during his time in service. And Indiana Public Media, which is the public radio and TV stations in Bloomington at IU, had a chance to make available for their readers on the websites what Peter T. Matthews was doing as he was serving his time at the Union Army. And with us to talk about the offerings that are up there online is one of the digital team for Indiana Public Media, Becca Costello. Becca, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit first about Peter T. Matthews. Who was he? How did he end up serving in the Union Army out of Indiana?
Peter Thomas Matthews was the oldest of 12 children. He was actually born in England, but he moved with his parents and the rest of his family here to the United States in about 1849. He was only 8 years old at the time. But then his father actually founded a quarry business down here in South Central Indiana in Monroe County.
Mm-hmm.
So he worked in the family business in the quarry. And then when he was 20 years old, the Civil War started. And the way that soldiers mostly joined the Union Army at the time is a sort of a local regiment would join up and just ask for volunteers there in that local area. So the one in his area was the 19th Indiana Regiment, and he joined the band there, and he served as a drummer.
How did he end up being in the band as opposed to just being a regular soldier?
There's some things about Matthew's life that we just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We know, obviously, that he was a musician. And from his diary entries, he talks a lot about playing in the band. And we don't believe that he fought in any battles, at least according to the records that we have. But he did fight in a regiment that later participated in some pretty major battles in the Civil War.
Now, you had a chance to get the diary and be able to put daily notes from each day that he had made notes in his diary about what was going on at the time. And it was very interesting to note what life must have been like for somebody who was a member of the regimental band, and in this case in particular, what he was doing at the time. How did he particularly get along, first off, with his band members, and for that matter, too, with his officers and other who are in command at the regiment?
So he talks a lot about the different people that they've been asked to play for. So a lot of his diary is made up of, you know, General so-and-so asked us to play for this other regiment. They often will meet up with a regiment from another state, and they play with their band as well. Some of his entries talk about hearing President Abraham Lincoln speak. He gets pretty excited when that happens. That's been a couple of times. And it looks like, you know, the band just kind of traveled around throughout the territory of where things were happening. And they were sort of lifting people's spirits as they played these different things. One of the things I think is interesting about his entries is he talks a lot about food. He tends to get excited when they go somewhere and they're invited in for dinner. And he likes to give a sort of a laundry list of all of the food items they were able to eat, because that's always a special treat for them.
Do you get the impression that the rations that they must have had while they're out there serving as Union soldiers wasn't very tasty?
I get that impression, yeah. And so when they get the opportunity to be in, you know, in the Capitol and have a special dinner with some champagne, there was one anecdote where they were invited by one general to partake in some champagne after their performance. And he was excited because one of his bandmates was able to drink after the general's daughter. She had drunk some champagne from a glass, and then he drank right after her, and they thought that was the most amazing thing.
Now, can you share with us some of the diary entries that was made in one particular time? This was the diary entry that ended up on the Indiana Public Media website back in earlier in December of what Peter experienced as he was traveling with the band, and what it was like to be outside of Indiana at the time, in wintertime, I guess, in the sunny South. What was it like to be down there? I'm sure it was a climate that he probably never experienced.
It's interesting. Some of them are pretty short, and he does just mention the weather, but it's interesting that you mentioned the weather. Yeah, he was a Hoosier who was spending time in the South. He says, on December 10th, this is the most beautiful weather and has been since the month began. And he says, equaling the climate of the sunny South in pleasantness. We think he was probably somewhere in Virginia at that time. At least we know on Christmas Day, which was later in December, that he was in Virginia at that point. But we don't know exactly the movements of the regiment.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he cared. Obviously, the weather was something when they're traveling around the country. It impacted their lives daily. Later on, he talks about deciding to get with some other people in the regiment, and they go hunting for logs so they can build themselves a little log hut instead of having to sleep in the tents when it gets really cold there in the winter. So something that was definitely top of mind pretty often.
Now, one other entry, too, I note that it was back in late November, was serenading the President of the United States. Yep, that's Abraham Lincoln. What was his thought about being able to perform at the White House?
That's one of the longest entries in his diary so far, even longer than his Christmas Day entry, where he reflected a lot on the year. But yeah, pretty exciting for him to play for the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. It looks like on that day they also traveled quite a bit throughout the Capitol there to play for all different kinds of important people. He talks about supper again, a nice oyster supper.
Well, it's great food. You know, he probably never thought that he'd get a chance to eat at the White House or even outdoors.
For sure. Yeah. Got an anecdote here on that day when he played for the president that he says, one of our number came near to getting us in a rumpus with a workman on the street. And he basically, it seems a member of his regiment was drunk and got into a bit of a fight with somebody, and they had to calm everybody down.
We know that that being a member of even just a regimental band is the rest of the problems that the other soldiers in the Union Army faced if they were not out there on the front lines an awful lot, if they were with a more sedate regiment, as I'm sure that the Indiana regiment must have been, although I'm sure they saw their share of battles or at least participated in them too. We know that it's always been said that about the Civil War is that basically there was hours of boredom punctuated by moments of terror. Do you know if Peter ever had any opportunities to talk about what it was like to have to spend the hours doing virtually nothing, at least in this case here, between battles or between performances for that matter?
It does seem like he's kind of just spending his days the best he can. I think being in the band, they had sort of an extra purpose that other soldiers not in a regimental band may not have had. He talks a lot about even just taking care of their instruments when they get a chance to go into town to pick up pieces to take care of their instruments, to keep them in good shape so that they can keep playing. So that's something that, you know, would have occupied some of his time in a way that others would not have had. As far as we know, he didn't fight in any battles. He completed his service before, within just about a year. And as far as we know, that this regiment was not involved in any battles.
Mm-hmm.
But he does talk quite a bit about hearing near gunfire and hearing reports of how the war is going in other parts of the country. So he was definitely sort of on the verge of that. But like you said, just spending a lot of time just passing the time away and missing home.
Now, how did you folks at Indiana Public Media in Bloomington get hold of Peter T. Matthews's diary?
We have a local historical society, the Monroe County History Center, and they take donations of all kinds of things like this. Since the Matthews family lived for a long time in Monroe County, and they had a lot of local impact here on the economy because of that quarry, so a pretty important family here, and some descendants had donated items from the Matthews family, and one of them was this diary from Peter Matthews. And they had just gotten it a couple months before we found out about it. They hadn't published it anywhere. Nobody had really read it in, you know, years. So I said, you know, can we just start publishing these entries? Would that be something that you think people would have interest in? And so they've been working with us to edit those entries to make sure that they're as accurate as possible, because his handwriting is a little bit difficult to read.
Yeah, you get to note that. You get to note that in some of the entries that are in there on the website about that. Yeah, it's a strange spelling and things like that.
Strange spelling. In some cases, we just have to put illegible because we really are not sure what he was trying to communicate. And we want to, you know, be the closest as possible to what he was writing at the time.
Now, how long in the entries does he go? He said, you mentioned that there's short entries and long entries, and obviously if you only have, for example, just one book, basically, that he had put all these entries in, how many more entries from the start of the series that you've put out there online will the entries from his diary go?
That's a good question. I'm actually waiting to hear back from the History Center on that. They are keeping the actual physical book there at the History Center. So they're just sort of electronically sending me the entries about every 2 weeks. So I'm hoping they can give me a sense of when the last entry is, and we can plan ahead for that.
But they're going on as we speak now. It's the Diary of Peter T. Matthews, a Hoosier Civil War soldier, that's been made offered has been offered up online on the Indiana Public Media website. Indiana Public Media is of the public radio and television services of Indiana University in Bloomington. And we've been talking with one of the members of the digital team there at Indiana Public Media, Becca Costello, about the Diary of Peter T. Matthews, the interesting life of what it was to be a soldier in this particular case, to be a member of a regimental band from Indiana. Thank you very much, Becca, for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you so much.
And our thanks not only to Becca, but also to Joseph Pete of the Times of Northwest Indiana and his colleague Dan Carden at the State House for the Times for the latest updates, and from Greg Tejeda with the Post Tribune for updates around the city of Gary. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday.